Well, you know, at the end of the day, we're here to generally seek pleasure, enjoyment, contentment, fulfillment, pride, a little bit of hedonism. You know, we're here to seek the real-time moments, like right now, that we are able to breathe in and smell and take in and enjoy. And if all we do is, as you say, build up that savings account by depositing healthy behaviors and choices and never get a chance to extract the marrow from life, it defeats the purpose.
It isn't about being perfect. It's about being better. Hello, my name is Dr. Stephanie Stima, and I host expert discussions with thought leaders in all facets of health, including nutrition, fitness, hormones, stress management, performance, recovery, longevity, health span, and energy production. On this show, we discuss complex science, but then we also alchemize it into actionable everyday living. The ultimate goal with the show is to assist you in making informed decisions about your health and to catapult you into being the hero in your own life. Hello, my Betties. Welcome back to another episode of Better with Dr. Stephanie. It's me, your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. And today I am bringing you a conversation on longevity, on foods that impact our health span and our lifespan, exercises, and our biomechanics with the one and only Mark Sisson. If you haven't heard of Mark Sisson, he is the founder of Primal Kitchen. You probably have some condiments in your fridge by that company. He's also the founder of the Primal Health Coach Institute. He's a New York Times bestselling author with the Keto Reset Diet. He's a publisher of marksdailyapple.com, which is the number one ranked blog for over a decade in the health and fitness category. Mark attended the University of Massachusetts, where he earned a degree in physical education. After college, he became a professional triathlete and competed in the Ironman Triathlon World Championships in Hawaii. And just as a little piece of information, he is one of the original health coaches and influencers to talk about metabolic flexibility. So he coined the term and was talking a lot about this idea, along with Rob Wolf, at the same time talking about this idea of being able to switch from being a sugar burner to a fat burner. So in today's episode, we are talking to Mark, who is 70 years old and looks like $1 million in terms of what are some of the constituents of living a long and healthy life. We talk about foods, we talk about foods to avoid, foods to consume, we talk about protein intake, we talk about exercises that he thinks about as a 70-year-old in terms of what are some of the low-level activity and high-level activity exercises that he wants to be able to perform throughout his life. And then we talk about biomechanics and specifically the biomechanics of the feet and why this is so important for exercises like squats and walking and overall health and well-being. And we talk about his new company, Paluva, which is a five-toed shoe, I should say, which is absolutely gorgeous. I have a pair and we were talking a lot about some of the functionality of that as well. So this is a jam-packed conversation. I think you're going to get a lot of value out of it. Please share with anyone far and wide who you think will benefit from living a long, healthy life to 70 and beyond. All right, please enjoy my conversation with Mark Sisson. One of my goals this year is to make it my best year ever with my skin. And one of the ways that I'm doing that is with the Boncharge Red Light Neck and Chest Mask. Wrinkles, acne, scarring, skin roughness, loss of collagen and elastin happen in the face and in the neck and the décolletage area on our chest where the skin is very thin and susceptible to skin damage. I think at this point we're all pretty good about putting sunscreen on our face, but so many of us miss the neck and the chest area too. I use the Boncharge neck and chest mask daily for about 10 minutes in the morning while I'm checking emails. Their red and near infrared light waves together penetrate up to 5 to 10 centimeters below the skin surface. The red light reaches the skin's top layers and the NIR light targets the deeper tissues without UV exposure. And that's going to help reduce the fine lines, wrinkles, and to help ramp up collagen and elastin production. So I want you to head over and have your best skin with me this year. Go to boncharge.com/better. That's BETTER. And use the discount code BETTER at checkout. And that's going to give you 15% off your entire cart. Transform your health and fitness with the Carol Bike, the smartest, most effective exercise backed by science. You can experience unparalleled results in just a minimum of 15 minutes per week. Per week, thanks to AI personalized workouts tailored to your age and your fitness level. You will increase fat loss, train up your strength and your speed, and have better energy, something that every woman, including myself, absolutely covets. I always say that women are the original biohackers. If there's a way for us to feel better and look better, we are all over it. Carol Bike, in my opinion, is one of the best pieces of cardio equipment that you can invest in. Studies prove that Carol helps you achieve a 12% increase in cardio fitness, lowers the risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and reduces blood pressure by 5% in as little as 8 weeks. Begin your transformation with the Carol Bike today and enjoy $100 off using the promo code BETTER for our beautiful Better Podcast listeners. That's B-E-T-T-E-R. All you have to do is visit carolbike.com. Mark Sisson, I am delighted to welcome you to the Better Podcast today. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Stephanie. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm so excited for our conversation. You are somebody that I have followed personally for many, many years, have implemented a lot of the principles that you have spoken publicly about, that you've written about. And so this is like the pleasure is all mine to host this conversation. And I think we're going to have a really fun, super juicy, nerdy conversation, the best kinds, of course, on longevity, on biomechanics, on exercise, food, and how all of those can really augment the experience that someone has in their life. So I'm excited to have it with you.
Awesome. Me too.
Yeah. So let's, one of the things that I sort of admire, I'll just start with my admiration really for you, is that you're someone who really walks the walk. There are a lot of people who are in the, you know, health space, in the longevity space, in, you know, just in general online, who talk about longevity and health span. And really, you are one of the people that I see who really walks the walk, talks the talk. And certainly, like, do you mind sharing your age, how old you are now?
I'm 70 now.
You're 70 now. And you look like this is like you and your wife truly are goals for me, in terms of how to really extract every inch of, you know, happiness and joy and vitality, out of life. So I thought we might start with talking about food, because food, as you know, many people have said, is medicine. You certainly have talked about this in a lot of your work. And for a 70-year-old, let's say, or someone who's 50 or 60, what are some of the things that we want to think about when we're thinking about health, not just longevity? So longevity is like the light, like how long we live, but mm-hmm. how good those years are. So our health span, like the years that we spent that are good, not on medication, you know, have an independent life, have excellent mobility, all the things. What are some of the foods that you think about that can help augment that experience to increase your health span?
Well, you know, it's funny. Recently, protein has been making it the rounds as the sort of preeminent macronutrient.
The popular girl at the high school, finally.
Exactly. I like to start with the things that we shouldn't be eating, though. That's kind of
sure.
the.
Let's start.
You know, I think you know, if you understand how the body works, and if you understand how things can go wrong with the signaling that happens in the body as a result of the food that we eat, or the accumulation of fat, or the accumulation of toxins, or the accumulation of reactive oxygen species, free radical damage, and things like that, then you would start by getting rid of sugar and sweetened beverages and sweetened, you know, extra sweetened whatever, pies, cakes, candies, cookies, the dessert sort of stuff. And when you talk about old people, it used to feel to me like people who were in their 60s and 70s and 80s just had to have dessert, right? Dessert was like the most important part of the meal.
Yeah.
part of the culture, I think.
Yeah.
And yet it's pretty clear that the less sugar we burn over a lifetime, the better off we are. So no matter what age you are, I would say starting by identifying those areas of your diet that contain sugars, added sugars, be a great place to start. Then I would go to the industrial seed oils. Again, those have been making the rounds the last 10 years, but basically understanding that many of these oils, soybean oil, corn oil, safflower, sunflower, canola, they are antithetical to health, and yet they're pervasive. They're in all of the processed foods that we eat for the most part. So you get rid of the sugars, you get rid of the industrial seed oils. For most people, you might want to get rid of processed grains. And now you come down to a fairly short list of foods that I would say are acceptable for a diet that is intended to improve muscle mass, to improve energy, to increase longevity. And it's meat, fish, fowl, eggs, nuts, seeds, vegetables, fruit, maybe some starchy tubers, right? So it's a fairly short list. Now, the good news is that there are so many things that we can put on these foods, so many sauces and dressings and toppings and methods of preparation and way of cooking them and herbs and spices, that we can create a pretty much infinite variety of taste opportunities in creating a diet based around that sort of a list. And I want to be clear that I enjoy food. So even though I would say food is, 80% of what most people have to overcome when they're trying to regain excellent health, get your diet dialed in and you will be well on your way toward regaining energy and vitality and health. And having said that, I still love food and I still want to make sure that every bite of food I put in my mouth tastes fantastic. So I do, curate my daily diet from that sort of a list, but make sure that I am able to enjoy, the occasional treat here or there, the occasional piece of dessert, if you will, or a bite of dessert, the occasional slice of pizza once in a while. But I would say that it's number one, avoiding the sugars and the industrial seed oils, which is key. And then focusing on protein as the primary macronutrient that would, be the centerpiece of every meal that you eat.
Yeah. And protein is one of the, I think it is the only macronutrient that really our requirement changes as we age, right? So, you've talked about limiting our carbohydrates maybe through the entire lifespan. But as we age, I think that it becomes more important to increase our protein as we age because of some of the things that can set in, like more anabolic resistance for the muscle tissue itself, insulin resistant naturally as well. And then just the natural, if you're not being strategic about it, and we'll talk about exercise in a moment, but if you're not being strategic about how to preserve lean muscle mass, you're losing about 1% of it a year, right? So you're losing about 10% per decade, let's say, on average. And of that, when we're losing muscle fibers, when we sort of divide it into muscle fiber type, you're also losing proportionately more type 2 fibers. We mm-hmm. lose our speed, we lose our explosive ability, our power as well. So and I would love for you to weigh in on your thoughts around protein and the sort of changing requirements. If you adhere to that, I mean, I've just
I totally adhere to it, I'd say because I've always been a fan of protein and I've always had protein lead the way when I'm crafting an eating strategy. Protein, as we get older, we lose some of the digestive enzymes that we count on as for younger people. And digestive enzymes are necessary to break down these proteins that we eat into amino acids that the body can use. It's a combination of maybe because we don't absorb as much of the amino acids, we need to eat more protein just to present the opportunity to the body. It's also a reason that many people, I think, would be well advised to consume dietary enzyme supplements, right? Dietary supplements that are enzymatic in nature that would assist in the digestion of those proteins. Having said that, there's a point at which I think you can't really absorb more than, say, 50 grams of protein in a meal. I mean, it's a giant steak or whatever. So I think, now if we're talking about, people as you're getting into your 60s and 70s and you see that decline in muscle mass, that's where maybe a protein supplement, a shake or something in the morning could be useful to kind of shore up those protein stores. If you're not, and I think a lot of people as they get older their appetite tends to diminish a little bit as well. So you're going to really have to be careful about making sure that you take in enough protein. But again, that's really on the like, I'm not even there yet. I'm 70. I'm not even, that's later on down the road. But my in-laws, for instance, are in their 80s and early 90s. So we have to be really careful that they get enough protein.
Yeah.
And that's where the shakes, come into play.
And it's interesting. I'm often asked, so I wrote a book on the introduction of the ketogenic diet for women and why it's important for as a proxy for improving insulin sensitivity and some of the things that we've been talking about. But even in my call it formulation of that ketogenic diet, so it's like very low on carbohydrates, but still quite moderate in its protein. I was asked recently, like, do you still recommend the ketogenic diet? And it's like, yes, I do. For someone who has been, let's say, eating a standard American diet for however many years and is used to some of these hyper palatable foods, who has no idea how many carbohydrates, let's say, that they're taking in. It's probably undernourished and on their protein intake. Mm-hmm. I do think that it's a wonderful therapeutic intervention for someone to improve their insulin sensitivity, to teach their body, you know, with when you combine it with fasting and things like that, to teach, you know, to get your body into that sort of lipolytic, that fat burning, ketone producing kind of state. And I think long term, what we've been talking about with increasing your protein over time, I think that that is a really smart strategy, especially when, you know, I always like to start with nutrition with people. As you said, you know, if you dial in your nutrition, you are going to be further ahead than, you know, probably 80% of Americans, let's say. And then you can start layering, you can start habit stacking with other things like lifting weights and sprints and other cardiopulmonary, you know, activity. Then we can start playing around with your protein requirements, because then they're going to also go up as well. I wanted to ask you a question, because you mentioned like 50 grams of protein. I often see, and this is, you're one of the first people to talk about, at least as far as I can tell, around this concept of metabolic flexibility, which is that glycolytic, lipolytic, being able to sort of switch sugar burner, fat burner. Mm-hmm. What I see now online is almost a distortion, I think, of what your original principles were talking about. Whereas sometimes you'll see people say you have to have 30 grams every morning, like 30 grams of the, you know, 30 grams at breakfast and 30 grams every meal. And then it's like, okay, but sometimes I work out fasted. And then, you know, and then other times I have 55 grams of protein in the morning because I wake up hungry and, you know, or I have leg day that day. And I know I want to, you know, make sure that my legs and my body have the substrate in order to kind of perform the activity that I want. I would love for you to talk a little bit about, maybe we'll say, the original intention of metabolic flexibility, and then how we can also use that principle to induce more cognitive flexibility as well when we're thinking about nutrition.
Sure. Well, you know, the idea of metabolic flexibility is pretty simple. It's just it's tapping upon the genetic recipe that we all have to be able to extract energy from whatever fuel source is required for the work being done at the time. So what it means is, if you're metabolically flexible, you can extract energy from the fat stored on your body when you're doing low level and even some high level aerobic work. Certainly as you're cruising around all day long throughout the day. If you're metabolically flexible, you can derive energy from the fat on your plate of food, from the glycogen in your muscles when you're doing glycolytic work, when you're in the gym doing heavy, heavy lifting or high intensity stuff, from the glucose in your bloodstream, which is what's fueling your brain, at least most people who are glucose dependent throughout the day. So you can burn the glycogen in your muscles. You can burn the glucose in your bloodstream. There's glycogen in your liver. Of course, you can tap into that. You can access the ketones that your liver makes in the absence of glucose. So metabolically flexible, it's the flexibility is what I call the holy grail. And so it's not about, okay, you must be keto to get there, or you must be doing intermittent fasting to get there, or you must be a combination vegan, like Mark Hyman would talk about, or I'd rather be vegan or whatever. It almost doesn't matter. There are ways in which you can develop this flexibility so that you become good at burning fat. You become fat adapted, as we say, and keto adapted. You get to the space where your body builds the metabolic machinery to burn fats more efficiently, more effectively. The mitochondria increase in number, their efficiency increases. Now you can become really good at burning fats. When you become that efficient at burning fats, the muscles go, hey, we don't need ketones. I mean, you know, we save that for the brain. And so the brain relies, in the absence of glucose, can now thrive in the presence of ketones. And so you develop this, again, this flexibility, this metabolic flexibility and metabolic efficiency that then translates into more energy all day long, greater resistance to metabolic disease, greater tendency to build or preserve muscle mass, greater tendency to do those, greater ability to put those on. And the number one benefit is your hunger dissipates, your hunger and appetite and cravings decrease. And so now you have control over your life because you know that in the absence of any sort of upcoming meal, your body's just going to say, I'm going to need 500 calories for the next 6 hours. I'm going to take it off my butt or my thighs or my hips or intramuscularly or whatever, wherever the fat exists. And if I go to the gym and I haven't eaten since last night, which happens to me all the time, I go to the gym and I do heavy leg days fasted. Some people would say that's not wise, but I'm not only able to do it, I feel good doing it. And I feel like it's enhancing that metabolic flexibility because I'm burning fat in the interim when I'm not doing the glycolytic work of the heavy leg day. And yet when I'm doing the glycolytic work of that day, my body doesn't forget how to burn glucose. It doesn't forget how to burn glycogen. That's always there. And so you become this sort of empowered individual who's able to kind of take advantage of all of the benefits that a strong, powerful, healthy human being can provide for oneself if they do the right work.
And I think there's something to say about the joy that can bring back to your life. You had mentioned, you know, I want my food to taste good. And we don't want to be nitpicking about, oh, like what oil was it? I mean, maybe you want to be concerned about the oil, as you mentioned with the seed oils, yeah. But you can rest assured that your body's going to know what to do, how to assimilate the cells, tissues, glands, organs, whatever, with whatever you're giving it. And, you know, if you travel to Europe, as sometimes we do, and you have a cornetto in the morning with a cappuccino, you know, it's fine if you're doing that here and there, right? Rather than beating your, because I say this from sort of experience with my community in that sometimes we are, and my community tends to be female and they're very, they need to get it right. Everything needs to be right all the time. There's sort of this orthorexic kind of tendency that I notice, particularly my high achieving women. And they just beat themselves up. They have a croissant and they're, you know, yeah. Or they have an extra slice of cheesecake or whatever, and they're off the rails for days. Yeah. It's like if you just trusted in, like, just get back.
Well, and they're not metabolically off the rails. They're just mentally off the rails. It's
right.
Not, you know, they violated some code that they set with themselves. Look, I've been there. I know that. But the point of metabolic flexibility is to be able to have that croissant or to be able to have that piece of cheesecake. And not have it be a guilt session and not have to go to therapy to deal with the aftermath of it. The metabolic flexibility describes this ability to go in and out of all these different substrates and not be at the effect mentally from having, you know, overdosed on sugar when you were keto for the last, you know, 8 weeks and all of a sudden you have a 300 gram carb day. That's not the sort of thing I'm espousing. But if you're metabolically flexible, you can have a 200 gram carb day and a 0 gram carb day followed, and one after the other. And if you do this right, and if you become metabolically flexible, which includes doing the high intensity work, doing the occasional intermittent fasting, so you do skip meals, eating sometimes what I would call fractally. So some days eating two meals, some days eating no meals, some days eating three meals, some days eating one meal, some days a big meal, a small meal. There's no order of events that you have to consume food in to dial in some optimal, perfect way in which you extract the energy and build the muscle. It's, again, it all comes back to what I call this holy grail, this metabolic flexibility. If you built the flexibility, now you have the leeway to play around in the margins and then come back. And for me, because I like to eat and I don't like being so dogmatic on my diet. I want to be able to play in the margins. I want to be able to go to Europe and have pasta and pizza, not every day, but certainly more than once in a while, shall we say, right?
Yeah.
But knowing that I've done the work and knowing that as long as I don't use that, you know, having gone outside the margins for a length of time, as long as I don't do it for weeks on end, I'll come back to center. I'll come back to this metabolically flexible person who can, you know, I suppose if you eat that cheesecake, you could say, if I'm metabolically flexible, all right, tomorrow's a leg day because I ate the cheesecake, I loaded my glycogen, I'm gonna take advantage of my carbo loading that I did inadvertently because I had, you know, an extra shot of tequila or whatever. And now tomorrow will be a leg day. You can have fun with this. You can play around with it rather than have it be this dogmatic thing that in the event that you stray, you beat yourself up.
I'm so happy you're talking about this because I think that what goes along with metabolic flexibility is this cognitive flexibility as well. This ability, to use your words, to play in the margins. Because, you know, I was talking to a friend recently. She just launched a book and we were texting about how busy she was and how overwhelming it was and how she hasn't slept and all this. And I said, you know, but what is the point of always being perfectly, always in bed at 9 o'clock? Like if you're always making these health deposits into your health bank account, let's say, sometimes you want to make a withdrawal, right? Sometimes you want to not sleep because you're launching a book, or maybe you don't need to launch a book to understand this example, but, you know, to go to Italy and have pasta and pizza, you know, like it's fine to play in the margins, as you said. And also to, you know, I often will say, like, the stress and the shame and the guilt and then the cortisol, like the sort of stress hormones that follow that are probably more damaging than the extra slice of cheesecake or the shot of tequila or whatever it was, because that lasts for days. You know, I sort of see people beating themselves up for days on end. So happy that you've articulated that. And there's some softness, right? Like there's some ability to play with that, which is lovely.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, And I've said this for a long time, you know, we're here to generally seek pleasure, enjoyment, contentment, fulfillment, pride, a little bit of hedonism. You know, we're here to seek the moments, the real-time moments, like right now, that we are able to breathe in and smell and take in and enjoy. And if all we do is, as you say, build up that savings account by depositing healthy behaviors and choices and never get a chance to extract the marrow from life, it defeats the purpose. It's like the guys, many of whom I know, who work their whole life building a business. And in so doing, they forego playing golf with their buddies. They forego going to soccer games with their kids. They forego dinners with their wives. And, you know, at the end of 20 years of doing this, maybe they've made a lot of money, but have they, you know, they haven't enjoyed life to its fullest in the real moments that life is all about. So I see that with people who are orthorexic, as you mentioned, in their dietary strategies, and certainly the same goes for their exercise strategies. I mean, there are people who, you know, I'm writing a book on walking now because I've discovered walking is the thing everybody should be doing. And I was a runner for 3 decades. And I would beat myself up if I missed a day of running, if there was something scheduled, you know, at the track that I was supposed to do and I didn't feel like doing it or didn't have the, not that I would choose not to do it, but because I couldn't because of an injury or because of, you know, I was had a cold or a flu, you know, I'd start getting on my own case about, you know, that's not tough. That's not, you gotta be tough. You gotta get in the trenches. You gotta, no pain, no gain, you know, all of these buzzwords that came out of the 80s and 90s that I think made a lot of people really feel guilty about their life, when in fact they should be feeling good about their life and seeking the pleasurable moments and have it be such that their diet and their exercise routine were a small subset of this life, but not the primary focus.
Yeah, beautifully said. Let's talk a little bit about exercise. You mentioned running. In the sort of same vein of longevity, we've been talking about protein and muscle mass. Why is muscle mass so integral, do you think, to longevity, to fostering independence, for mobility? What how do you view muscle mass as a proxy for longevity?
It's not just a proxy; it's just absolutely necessary because. First of all, if we want to define a quality of life in terms of longevity, it's basically two things. I think it's mobility, the ability to move around this world to walk over to a friend's house or to get on a plane and fly to Italy. And it's cognition, the ability to have a conversation with that friend next door or to learn a language when you go to Italy, or access to memories, right? So you could create these memories, these experiences that we're talking about, this, these moments of joy, contentment, fulfillment, satisfaction, and be able to remember them. So those are the two, I think, defining factors of a quality of life in terms of longevity, mobility and cognition. Now, muscle mass. Well, so the body, you know, has a tendency to want to sit around and do nothing. We are, as animate organisms that evolved over millions of years of, life in harsh environments before we were mammals, but even since we were mammals, harsh conditions, scarcity of food, we developed a number of strategies to stay alive long enough to pass our genes along to the next generation. And one of those strategies was the body tends not to want to waste resources doing something it absolutely doesn't have to do. It doesn't want to do. So fat is a great example. You know, we have this amazing capacity to convert extra calories that we eat, that we overeat. We're wired to overeat. And we convert those into energy that we carry around with us on our bodies directly over the center of gravity. It's an amazingly elegant development. And then when in times of scarcity, we can call upon those stored fat deposits and use those for fuel, combust those to get through the next several days. So we have this this ability to store fat and to burn fat. But the body says, fat's precious. Like, I don't want to burn fat if I don't have to. And so people tend, like when you talk about people have a high carbohydrate diet, because the body also burns sugar very easily and readily, if all you ever give it is carbohydrate, the body says, I don't need to tap into these precious fat stores. I'm going to have another carbohydrate meal. I'm going to make more glucose in the next 2 hours, the next 3 hours. So there's this tendency to do things that the body, that calls upon in, it remembers from surviving, you know, 2 million years ago. Well, building muscle is one of those things. The body doesn't like to waste precious resources building muscle unless it has to. So if you are young and you're playing and you're working and you're active, your body builds muscles because it knows you have to, you need the muscles to do that again tomorrow and again the next day. As you get older, the muscle mass decreases. And then as you get even older, the muscle mass starts to atrophy. If you don't do the work, those muscles just say, we don't need to be strong. Why, we're not lifting anything. We're not digging ditches. We're not climbing ladders. We're just hanging out. So why do we need to waste any precious resources being building more muscle or maintaining the muscle that we have? So there's a tendency toward this atrophy. But when you look at the body, the muscles are one part of a body that has a lot of different moving parts. So when you decide to move and move hard and fast, your heart says, "Up, okay, I'm called into action. I have to start pumping faster because the brain made a decision to go to the gym and lift weights, or the brain made a decision to go out and ride a bike for 2 hours. So now the heart says, I have to pump harder to supply oxygen and energy to these muscles. The lungs, you have to breathe more deeply to take in the oxygen so that the heart can pump that. The liver has to work harder to clear the toxins, to create the glycogen for to be used for glucose for the brain, or to create free fatty acids or ketones. The liver has to be called into action. The kidneys have to work harder. So all of the organs in the body need to keep up with the demands of the muscle. So when you choose to build muscle, the body is saying, all right, I didn't want to build muscle. I just want to hang out on the sofa and watch TV. But if you're going to go to the gym and do this, all right, the heart has to work harder. The lungs have to work harder. Liver has to work harder, and so on. Now, what does that look like? Well, when you're 80 years old and you get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom because your bladder is weak, and you trip over the cat and you fall and break your hip. Well, you break your hip probably because, first of all, you didn't have the balance and coordination from the muscular strength and development of that balance part of your repertoire. Number two, you land on your hip. Your hip is, it breaks because your bone density has failed because you haven't been doing weight-bearing activity. The bones don't need, it's the same thing. The bones are going, why do I need to get strong? If we're not going to do anything hard that's going to put us in jeopardy, the bones tend to, they atrophy as well. So if you haven't done deadlifts or things like that in the gym, now the hip bone fractures easily. So now you've got a broken hip. Now you wind up in the hospital, and typically you go to a hospital with a broken hip, you get pneumonia. Well, when you get pneumonia, your lungs fill with fluid, and because you haven't been deeply breathing for the last 20 or 30 years, you can't, your lungs are not strong enough to withstand either the pneumonia or the filling of fluids or the coughing out of the sputum, the clearing of that. Your heart, which has been beating only at 10% capacity for the past 20 years because you haven't been doing the exercise to require it to stay strong. So the heart has at best now only 10% or maybe 20% of its prior capacity. So now the heart gets overwhelmed and you die of congestive heart failure, or you die of septicemia, or you die, your liver gives out or your kidneys give out. It's the weakest organ people don't die of old age. They die of organ failure. And whatever that weakest link is, it all circles back to muscle mass and the requirement that when you build muscle mass, it requires every organ in the body to keep up with it. Does that make sense?
Oh, that's so well said. And like, just to add on with that broken hip, the other thing we see is, like, you know, you've been talking about the two main things, mobility and cognition. You see a massive cognitive decline. Someone who's fractured their hip, they have some type of, you know, the dementia that sort of sets in much earlier than it otherwise would, or even their ability to get out of the hospital. I think I read something, it was a couple months ago now, but something like 50% of people who go into the hospital, this is CDC data, 50% mm-hmm. of people who go into the hospital never get out.
Yeah.
Like, they're incapacitated. Like, if you're 70, like, you're just, you know, 70 and above, if you're not thinking about muscle mass, you are one fall away from dying.
You know,
it is very,
it's a brutal, it's a brutal thing to say, and yet it's so real. If you look at the statistics, what I just described is not a unique one-off a scenario. That's the cascade of what happens. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to your point, at least what I observe, you can sort of get away with not doing resistance, even though I don't agree with it, but you can get away 20s, 30s, you can kind of get away with not doing, you know, having a strategic plan for that. But the rate of decline in health that I have observed in women, I mean, my community is mainly women, but this applies for men and women, in their 40s and 50s, and then in their 50s and 60s, it's nonlinear, which I think is also important to consider, because I think that humans, we tend to think, you know, there's a graph, there's an X and a Y axis, and then there's like a straight line or a straight line, but it's really an exponential decline sort of after 40. And for women who are going through menopause, or at least, it, you know, in their 40s or in perimenopause, and then somewhere around 50, 51, 52, they enter into 12 consecutive months without a period. What their experience is like with lower muscle mass, you know, you mentioned the liver being able to process fuel more efficiently and, you know, detoxify the body. Like, this is also a really big deal for hot flashes. If you can't detoxify properly and you can't metabolize your estrogens in the way that you used to, you're going to have a really rough time in menopause. And then the sleep changes, the thermoregulatory changes that happen in perimenopause, the mood and the affect, all of these things can be positively influenced with regular resistance training of some kind.
I mean, it's a magic pill. If there was a panacea for people over 50, it would be lifting weights. And it's not a big, you know, it's not a huge commitment. I mean, it's twice a week for most people. But, you know, with specific guidelines and done appropriately, you don't need to do that much to achieve incredible benefits that last a long time.
I am incredibly bullish on sauna as a therapy for recovery, heart health, and overall aging well. I personally decided on an infrared sauna from Sunlighten because of the range of far wavelengths and near infrared wavelengths that it offers. Saunas help with detoxification and rejuvenation to rid your body of toxins. It helps with heart health by improving circulation, reducing blood pressure, and helping keep the arteries supple. It helps with muscle recovery by easing the tension and soreness to recover faster, and of course, stress reduction. With the warmth and the relaxation of sitting in a sauna, it's crucial for hormonal balance and achieving a state of well-being necessary for a strong physique and a strong mind. If you visit sunlighten.com/better and use code better to get a discount, that is sunlighten, sunlighten.com/better, and use code better at checkout.
So let's say we have someone who is dedicated. They're like, okay, listen to Mark, I'm going to go twice a week. What are some of the movement patterns that you want to see somebody be able to do? Let's say in their 40s, and maybe they gain mastery of that over, you know, let's say the course of the next decade. What are some things that you want to see a 50 or a 60-year-old be able to do really well in the gym?
Squats. I mean, starting with air squats. I'd like to see somebody do 50 air squats, maybe three sets of 50 if it gets to that. But to be able to do air squats, to move from that to weighted squats. So squats. Some form of deadlift. So the hex bar deadlift, and again, doesn't have to be a lot of weight, but a hex bar deadlift is probably the single greatest exercise that someone can do, I think. And it's funny, as a former runner, I didn't do a deadlift until I was in my 40s. It was antithetical to running, I guess, I thought, but it wasn't. It actually turns out that some of the top runners now are deadlifting for the very reason that you want that muscle strength to, you know, that maximum sustained power on top of the endurance. I would do some, you know, lunges. I would do leg presses. I would hamstring curls of some kind for the lower body. And then for the upper body, I'd do, dips, and they can be assisted dips. You know, they have these machines that you can, you don't have to dip your whole body weight. Same with pull-ups. I would do pull-ups. So pull-ups, push-ups, dips, planks. You know, most of these are using body weight as the primary driver of the force. And therefore a lot of these can be done in the home. I think a lot of work can be done with a resistance band, you know, just doing, flies, you know, lateral raises and flies
You can do it with laundry bottles.
Yeah, like exactly.
If you don't have weights, some laundry, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. But there's probably, you know, it's only 8 exercises that people, I think, need to do. I think as they get older, they need to stretch a little bit. I do a day of dedicated stretching, once a week. And that's new to my repertoire. And that's also because a couple of reasons. Number one, I only lift twice a week. You know, you could lift 3 times a week, I guess, but as you get better and as you start to, actually do the kind of things that build muscle, you realize that if you're doing it right, you can't recover in 2 days or 3 days from that workout. In other words, if you're able to do it again the next day and the next day, you're probably not working hard enough to create that thing, that signal in the body where the body says, okay, I see what he's doing, or she's ramping up the intensity. Now we have to get stronger. Before, I could do all that stuff. I got used to it. I could hang. I could keep up. But you want to trick the body into making those changes that it theoretically doesn't want to make. You want to trick the body into building more muscle, not allowing yourself to atrophy, because the body tends to want to just, you know, chill out and decline. And by the way, I mean, that's until 40 years ago, you know, most people, when they were 60 or 65, they were over the hill, old, decrepit, waiting for the Grim Reaper, right? Unless they were, you know, very active or out on the, you know, out on the farm, you know, getting up every morning and milking the cows and doing all the activity stuff. But most people, when they worked in a factory setting and retired, they just withered away after a couple of years. Because that's the body saying, you know, there's no reason to build muscle mass because we don't work anymore. So you got to trick the body into doing these things sometimes.
And so those 2 days of lifting a week, are those full body days for you? Is that your protocol?
Yeah, I would say they are. Yeah. I think, again, you're asking, like, if somebody was going to start from scratch, I'd do 2 days a week. a full body training. And then I'd walk twice a week. And then I do one day a week of sprint training. Now, I don't mean running on the track necessarily, but what I mean is high intensity stuff where you're on like an assault bike or you're on a VersaClimber or you want even a stationary bike.
Well, those ERG ski ones, those are really good.
Exactly. The concept rowers.
Yeah.
Any of those things where you get your heart rate, you just go all out for 30 seconds and then rest for 2 minutes or 3 minutes and then go all out for 30 seconds and then do that again. So, you know, I wrote these guidelines probably 20 years ago, the Primal Blueprint, the 10 basic Primal Blueprint laws, and three of them were move around a lot at a low level of activity. That's the walk and move all day long. Like, get up from your desk and walk around and go for a walk and make calls on a walk and don't think of walking as a substandard exercise. It's actually one of the best things we can do as humans. And it's not about burning calories either, because you don't want to think in terms of, well, if I walk, I don't burn as many calories as I run. No, if you walk, you're putting your body through these planes of motion. You're out in fresh air. You're reinforcing a strong gait. You're burning nothing but fats while you're doing it. So you're not burning glucose or carbohydrates when you're doing that. So move around a lot at a low level of activity. That's the walking or cycling or swimming or other activities, of course. Lift twice a week. If you want, I mean, as I say, if you're really serious and you want to do three times a week, figure out if you can do that. But I say lift twice a week and then sprint once a week. And that's the basic, again, that's another template that will get you to 80% of your potential in terms of your strength, power, and fitness level.
And what is the time in terms of recommended time?
45 minutes to an hour in the gym. An hour, over an hour is too much. Usually an hour is too much for a lot of people. I say, you know, 35 to 45 minutes is kind of a nice little sweet spot there. I mean, I go to the gym. It's my cheers. It's my happy hour. I see people that I know at the gym. So I'll be there an hour.
I love the gym. It's so much fun. I love the people there. I don't see them anywhere else in my life. Yeah. Like, it's so great. Yeah,
exactly. So I do my 35 minutes of work, but I'll take an hour to do it, or an hour, 10 or whatever.
And what about walking? How long would you recommend walking? Like, how many minutes per week can you rack up, do you think?
Let's see. 200 minutes a week would be a good, that's an hour three times a week plus a 20-minute one in between. I think it's the best thing you can do. And it's almost like more is better. Is there a minimum? No, you can. The other day I had a bunch of things to do at podcasts. I had business meetings. So I went out and walked for half an hour, came back, did a podcast, went out and walked for half an hour, came back, did a business call, went out and walked for half an hour and came back. And it was a day that, you know, I wasn't going to lift that day because I'd lifted the day before. I need my recovery from the lifting. And I think walking is also anti-catabolic. Running is catabolic. Running tears you down. Now, for a lot of people, it's...
So is weightlifting.
Well, weightlifting can be, if you do it too much. But weightlifting is certainly anabolic if you do it right. Mm-hmm. Running tends to be catabolic. It tends to, like, if you've seen the best marathoners in the world, they have no upper body muscle. And they lift weights. They just can't keep it on. It's catabolic. The running is really creating the smallest efficient machine it can make. So, you know, I'm trying to give people permission to stop running and start walking more. And walking includes hiking and rucking, which is a big new thing now. And if you
I was going to ask you what you thought about rucking.
Mm-hmm. So I have a 20-pound weight vest that I walk with sometimes. I love walking uphill. If the weather's inclement and I'm at the gym and I'm listening to a podcast, I'll literally get on a treadmill, which I never thought I'd do in my entire life. But I'll get on a treadmill with a vest on and go, you know, a 10% incline. That's a great workout. It gets the heart rate up. Again, it's not jarring to the body the way running would be. It's just promoting all of the right sort of kinetic pathways from the bottom of the foot to the top. Of course, I do this in a special kind of shoes, Stephanie.
Yes. Well, this is a perfect segue, Mark, to one of the things I wanted to talk about was, rucking and walking and all these things are very important, but it's also important to be doing them right, in the same way that if you're going to be squatting, let's say, you know, you said start off with air squats. My experience when I was full-time in clinical practice, at least, was that not many people knew how to squat properly. And part of that was poor ankle dorsiflexion. So the flexion of the ankle joint was very limited, which would cause sort of a buckling in, you know, doctors will call this genu valgum, but it's basically like where your knees become knock-kneed. And then there's like either a posterior or an anterior pelvic tilt in order to compensate for it. So people were not squatting properly. Right. And I wanted to, talk about the importance of walking and even some of the other exercises that we've been mentioning, like squatting and deadlifting and all of and lunging and all of that. Really is, it's important to get your biomechanics right. And we can start at the feet because, you know, I'm right now I'm wearing your shoes, your Puluva shoes. I don't know if we can, if you're watching this on YouTube, you can probably see my Puluvas there. I wear them all day during the day. And let's see yours. Ah, you got the white ones.
I got the Miamis on. Yeah.
I like those.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the aesthetics in a minute because I was very, you know, this, I was very impressed with it, but we have 25% of our bones are in our foot. And then just for the nerds that are listening. So there's 25% of the bones. So 26 bones, 33 joints, 107 ligaments, 19 muscles. Like this is an important part of the body to be moving properly. So talk about feet, the importance of, we'll just start with walking and we can graduate to other movement patterns.
Sure. Let's talk about just generally the importance of foot health. I think foot health is the new sleep. I think it's been overlooked for far too long. If you think about it, our feet are our main connection to ground, to the earth. We use our feet to do everything from standing to squatting to moving around to walking to climbing. We use our feet all day, every day. And then we encase them typically in these narrow shoes that have lots of cushion on the bottom. And what that's doing is it's taking away all of the input that's necessary for the foot to inform the body how to move. So to take a step back, if we're born barefoot, clearly, and we evolved barefoot over millions of years. The foot is an incredible appendage that has tens of thousands of sensory nerves in the bottom of the foot. And every time you take a step forward, those nerves inform the brain exactly how to flex the foot ankle, how to bend the knee, how to torque the hip, how to flex certain muscles to absorb shock. When you're sprinting, a different thing happens, but it's the same concept. It's informing the legs of how to move, the knee how to bend, the hip how to move, the hip how to twist, and it relies on this sensory input. And now when we encase these feet in shoes and we put a cushion underneath, all that sensory input is lost. And now the foot has no guidance for the brain as to what do you do if you step sideways on a rock or if you step in a chuck hole or a squirrel hole on a field while you're jogging across a field and you roll an ankle. Why does that happen? Well, because if you were barefoot, you probably wouldn't roll your ankle because you're, by the time your foot moved enough over the hole, the brain would go, okay, we've got to bend the knee. Now you really got to bend the knee and absorb that shock and absorb that and absorb that shift in terrain and balance. So foot health is critical, and we've completely bypassed it. We've completely overlooked it. I was thinking the other day, you know, they use grip strength as a proxy for vitality and robustness in old people, right? It's sort of it's a proxy for how strong you are throughout your body. I think foot mobility should also be a proxy because so many people have such horrible, they've got osteoarthritis, they've got bunions, they've got plantar fasciitis, fungal infections because they've been enclosed in these, you know, steamy, hot coffins for so long. So when you talk about going to the gym and how you use your feet at the gym, like when you're doing deadlifts, most of the top lifters will say they will not lift in cushioned shoes because your knees are too delicate to trust that this little Bosu ball that you're standing on is going to withstand 1,000 pounds of the deadlift. So they would rather deadlift barefoot because they have complete contact with the ground and they've literally screwed their feet into the ground. They've widened their toes. They've splayed their toes out, so they have the greatest surface area of a pedestal, if you will, from which to lift. These are And then translate that over into squats and lunges. I mean, if you're doing lunges, you want the knee to bend appropriately. But you, in order to do that, you don't want to be trusting a thick cushioned running shoe that looks great but is rotating your knees to one side or the other with no haptic input from your feet, which are actually in contact with the ground the second you lunge forward. Those are, I think, examples of how you can really mess yourself up if you start doing heavy weights in thick padded running shoes or traditional sneakers, if you will. So I looked at this years ago, and I've always been upset at how narrow shoes are. I've always felt like my toes needed more room within the shoes. Even if I bought like an E or a double E width shoe, even though they're wide at the metatarsal, they still sort of come together at a point at the toe. So I took a look at all of the prior attempts at minimalist footwear, and I said, let's combine the best elements of an optimal shoe, which would be, first of all, the individually articulated toe box. So we have five toed shoes, because you want your toes to be able to splay outwardly for sure, laterally, but also you want them to be able to articulate up and down. If you step on different surfaces, if you step on a certain small rock, you want that whatever toe is hitting the rock, you want the toe to bend up, and you want it to feel the ground. You want the massage effect of walking over cobblestones or walking over rocky trails and having it feel amazing, having it feel wonderful. Like how did I ever hike in a stiff-soled hiking boot when I can feel more connected with the earth, more connected with the ground, more solid with my footing, wearing a thin-soled shoe that has five toes on it? So we developed a shoe to be, first of all, comfortable. I think it's the most comfortable shoe you'll ever wear. Once you understand and you start to wear these,
it's like a glove. Feels like a glove.
Exactly. Number two, it's functional. So it allows your feet to do what a foot is supposed to do. We say let feet be feet. It allows your foot to splay out, allows your foot to adapt to the changes in terrain. We call that ground feel. You can feel the ground underneath, and that's a good thing. And then we gave them attractive uppers. So we combined comfort, function, and style to create this line of shoes we call Paluva. And it's catching on all over in many different areas. And we've got a lot of movement specialists, a lot of physical therapists, a lot of trail runners who are hiking on their non-running days. They're hiking for hours at a time in Paluvas, strengthening their feet while they're walking. So they're not even running in these. They're just hiking, but hiking for a couple of hours. People are rucking in them. Again, that's just hiking with a backpack. Of course, a lot of people in the gym, I go to my gym down the street. Of course, a lot of my friends are there, and now it's great to see 20 people wearing my shoes in the gym and all feeling like they're improving the health of their feet as a result of that.
Yeah. And I would say too, like in sort of the spirit of transparency, I had to reteach myself to squat because I, you know, probably very similar to you, you know, wore the Adidas and the Nike and the Reeboks and the New Balances and all of these different shoes growing up. And when I would always injure myself at exactly the same weight. Like I get to 185 pounds on the squat, and without, like, I could predict that my knee was going to blow out. I was going to eat something on my knee or something on my hip, and then I'd have to come all the way back down, you know, back to the barbell and then rehab all the things that, you know, you go to the chiropractor, you go to the physio, you get the massage, all the things, and then you work back up. And then I would do the same thing over and over again. So I started taking my shoes off. When I was squatting, and what I found was my ankle mob, my ability to dorsiflex, my ability to bring my whole foot up towards me, very, very poor. My ability to splay. So, you know, as you said, like the Paluva shoe has like five individual sort of little glove, you know, like little place for your toes. I had a really hard time. You know, one of the cues for squatting is to sort of think about a triangle, right? So you splay the big toe, splay the pinky, and then you're sort of envisioning the pinky and the big toe and then the calcaneus back to the heel. I had a really hard time splaying the pinky. And so I had to reteach myself to squat. I still squat and deadlift barefoot. So I do it in my socks, or if no one's looking, I probably take my socks off. I may or may not take my socks off. But these are the shoes that I wear. These, since, you know, since receiving these and wearing these, I was, you know, to your point around the aesthetics, I was like, oh, I'm not sure. Cause I've seen like the Vibrams and I've seen either friends wear them or I've tried them on. And I'm like, I feel like I look like a hobbit. But they look great. And they, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know that they're a five toe
right.
shoe. Unless if you're like kind of staring at it and then you're, you know, whereas I think some of the other, let's say shoe makers, I'm thinking about Vibrams,
yeah.
Like, you know, that they're a five toe shoe. Like you can see the individual articulate, you know, sort of from before the person walks into the room, you can sort of see the toe.
Right. But no, for sure. These from the side, they look like a regular shoe. And even like what I'm wearing right now. And again, I'll show it to anybody watching on YouTube, but this is this is the Miami. It's a loafer. It's five-toed shoe, but it's a regular looking loafer. And you see this sidewall, right? Oh my God, that looks like a regular like cushion shoe. That's a fake sidewall. The shoe, we have 1.2 centimeters from the heel to the toe. It just was made to look like a shoe because we wanted people to think, well, it's, you know, it's a great shoe that you're wearing there.
Yeah.
It just happens to be very functional and very comfortable at the same time. My biggest issue was comfort. I have a lot of friends in the shoe business, and that's one of the reasons I was able to enter this space with some confidence. I have a lot of friends in the shoe business. Some over at On Running Shoe, which is the most successful running shoe story of the last decade, right? Maybe Hoka, but, I love the shoes. I think they look good, but I can't wear them. And when I say I can't wear them, I can wear them a little bit. I can wear them for an hour, but then my metatarsals start to cramp. And if, God forbid, I'm asked to walk on concrete for more than, say, 2 miles, my knees start hurting because what happens is, again, they're so thick that the foot doesn't know exactly what the terrain underneath looks like. And so the knee has to guess. Because the foot's not telling the brain, the bottom of the feet is not informing the brain of exactly what's going on underneath. Then the knee has to guess, the hip has to guess, and sometimes they guess wrong and you get a knee tweak, right? And that's what happens when you're deadlifting or squatting 180 pounds with Adidas on. The same thing is happening. It's because you don't have that input. Imagine your feet are just like hands. They really are. There's some people who are born without hands who use their feet as if they were hands. So there's that dexterity, right? But imagine being a pianist and then putting on oven mitts and then going off and playing some Rachmaninoff piece or something, right, on the piano. It's not going to happen. Well, that's what you're asking people to do who are wearing traditionally thick cushioned shoes. And I laugh at them because the minimalist movement really took off in 2010, 2011, when Chris McDougall wrote Born to Run. And he described the nature of the Tarahumara Indians who ran 50 miles a day and did all this cool stuff. And, you know, he talked about, yes, we're born to run, but we're born to run barefoot. And if we run barefoot, then we're forced to run with the proper gait, the proper stride. Most people heel strike and that's bad. But if you don't have cushioned heels, and you're running barefoot, you are forced to run with a proper midfoot landing. And so at the time, when minimalist shoes were just getting invented, people glommed on to minimalist shoes and thought, oh my God, this is amazing. I'm going to start running 7 miles in my minimalist shoes. Well, if you haven't trained to run with proper stride, if you haven't trained to run with a midfoot landing, 7 miles of that the first day is deadly on your feet. I mean, people got injured. People got hurt pretty badly because they were taking this concept and embracing it because they hadn't trained for it. So after a few years of that, people came along and thought, okay, this minimalist thing isn't working for runners. Let's take it all the way over the other direction and let's make a maximal shoe. Let's make a really thick shoe and let's just encourage people to heel strike, which was the antithesis of what Born to Run was about. So then we had a generation of shoes, these thick, 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 like almost ugly running shoes that people are wearing. And they think they're doing themselves a favor because they're running on clouds and they're running on, you know, pillows and thick cushions. But that's not what's happening. The rate of injury has not gone down as a result of these. They just get injured in different places.
Yeah. And I would say that running, you know, just for the listener, for as a clarifying point, walking heel strike for like to have a heel strike on walking is
100%
normal. But running is a different category of movement. And I actually remember a patient of mine teaching me this. Because we were taught in school, like heel strike, you know, you heel strike and then you slightly supinate and then your propulsion, you propel off of the big toe. Which is great for walking, right? This is the ideal movement pattern for walking. But I remember this one patient who I'm thinking of, he was an ultra marathoner and he's like, no, actually you should hit with the midfoot first. And then just like the heel just comes back and tap and it's, you know, sort of taps and it's so much more efficient in terms of energetic loss and, you know, in terms of keeping the ankle, you know, saving the ankle and saving the knee and saving the hips. And I remember thinking like, okay, this guy's running, you know, however, what's an ultra marathon, 50 miles, something like that. Yeah. I was like, and he's doing this year over year. Like there's something to this. So I remember many, many years ago being introduced to this idea that running is a different category of movement than walking.
Yes.
And that maybe it's the metatarsals that should be, or like the midfoot, we'll say, like the midfoot should hit first and then just the heel kind of just taps. And if you look in the animal kingdom, that's actually how, when you see at like high speeds, you see like the, you know, the, these like felines that are running at, you know, whatever speed that, like they're midfoot runners. So, just wanted to throw that out there.
No, it's important that you put it out there because the midfoot runners are few and far between. And so when you look at, you know, 40,000 people lining up to race in a LA marathon or whatever the number is, probably, you know, less than 1% are proper runners. The rest are heel striking. And, you know, it's a nice life challenge to run a marathon, finish a marathon, but it's not really running. It's jogging and it's doing a movement that is not good for the body in the long run, no pun intended. It's a, you know, so walking is a heel first gait off the big toe. Running is a midfoot strike, and as you said, the heel just taps, and that's because true running, whether it's sprinting or even, you know, long distance running at the elite level, you're just coiling the Achilles, right? The Achilles is one big spring. It's the calf and the Achilles. They stay coiled. And so you use the midfoot to just load that coil, that spring, and then bounce off it, 20,000 times or whatever the number is of repetitions that you're doing. So that's back to why I'm writing this book on walking, because I think too many people run inappropriately and they do so with the idea that it's going to be a weight loss strategy for them, right? And taking up running in trying to lose 30 pounds or 40 pounds is not a good idea. It doesn't work very often. People don't lose that kind of weight, and that's why you see that.
And so what many weight people, are you losing? That's the other question. Is it
well?
Fat?
No. But that's the other part. When I say running is catabolic, it's catabolic for those people too. So they're literally burning off some of the muscle tissue, and they're not really burning a lot of fat because of the way they're training and the way they're eating, because typically they're carbo loading, you know, to be able to go do it again tomorrow, and they're refilling their glycogen stores, and they're depending on glucose for their brain and glucose for their glycogen for their muscles, and it precipitates this cycle where you go run 8 miles and you burn off 750 calories, and you tend to go home and eat 900 calories to make up for it, because the body's going, what have you done to me? You know, this is an unnatural kind of thing that you're choosing to do, and I don't want to waste valuable resources, so I'm not going to tap into my fat stores unless you train me how to burn fat. And that's that whole metabolic flexibility thing. So people who are looking to lose weight and run a marathon, I would say start with the diet, start with walking, right? And so get your metabolic flexibility ducks in a row. Become metabolically flexible, start burning more fat at a higher aerobic output. Do it by walking. Walk faster and faster until such time as you can maybe throw in a couple of 100-meter jogs or not sprints, but runs where you're landing appropriately on the midfoot, and then walk again and kind of train into it slowly. But by all means, try to avoid this heel striking, because it's inefficient and it doesn't improve your fitness at all.
So what if you're somebody who, let's say you're listening to this, and you have been an orthotic wearing on running or whatever company, you know, cushion shoe wearing, we'll say, bunion like you have bunions on your feet,
plantar fasciitis,
you have plantar fasciitis, Achilles tendonitis, all the things. Yeah. How is it, do we just start wearing the puluvas? Is there a transition? It's the low level activity, as you mentioned.
Yeah, it's just, first of all, you're not going to run in the puluvas. I'm not going to let you run in the puluvas for a long, long time. So wear them when you're not running. Wear them when you're walking around the house. Wear them when you're going when you're out walking the dog. A lot of people report back to me, the first time I wore my puluvas was when I was out walking the dog and it was dark and so no one could see me. right? Because I was afraid I was going to get called out for the five-toed shoes. And then they get used, and then they say, oh my God, they actually look pretty nice. They look great. I love them now. But I would start relatively slowly, but even if you're reasonably fit, like I have people walk 5 miles the first day and go, dude, it's amazing. Like I got it. I'm in. You know, I understand it. My feet feel stronger. They feel tired from the walk. But my knees don't feel tired. My hips don't feel tired. My feet feel tired because my feet were finally working. The small muscles of my feet were finally working through every step of that entire walk. And you got to dig that when you're wearing those cushioned shoes and they're laced up tight, the small muscles of your feet are not working. The arch of your foot is supported, and so it's not working. So your arch atrophies, the small muscles of your feet atrophy. And then what you're doing is you're forcing the rest of your leg from the ankle up to do all the work. And again, that's a recipe for eventual disaster, which is why half of runners are injured, you know, every year, and 25% of all runners are injured at any one point in time. Like right now, 25% of all the people claim to be runners are injured. That doesn't speak well for that sport. That's worse than CrossFit.
Yeah. And I also want, like, I think about elite sports too, because I think about soccer, for example, where if you look at them, they're actually running, their heel strike is what we described. It's usually a mid stance with a little bit of, you know, especially when they're sprinting after the ball. But those shoes, man, those shoes are like bullet trains. They are small. And, you know, I know this because both of my boys play soccer. And so I'm often, you know, and the coaches will say the shoe's too big. The shoe has to be tight, molded around the foot. Because if there's any room, then it's going to change their perception.
They won't be able to strike the ball as well. That's the
feedback that we receive. So what is your hope maybe for, even for maybe it's soccer, maybe it's, you know, there's other.
Well, there's a company, I forget the name. It's a cool company. They're making a wide toe box soccer shoe. A cleat, if you will. Mm. And it's a great looking shoe. It's a great looking cleat. I can't remember the name of it. Cause I want to promote them. But people are working on this. We're thinking about making a stiff five-toed cycling shoe because I come from the cycling world.
The cycling shoes are the same. The
cycling shoes are the same. And so in the triathlon, you know, you ride in an Ironman, you ride 112 miles, you get off the bike and your feet are numb from being so cramped for so long. And then you have to run on them and you have to actually call upon them to, you know, to strike the ground and do all the things that you're supposed to do when you're running. So I feel like we're leading the way for a real revisiting of sportswear, sports shoes and cleats and things like that, because I think we've overlooked this for so long. The assumption that soccer cleats have to be tight, it may go back to something that happened in the 1920s where somebody said the leather was too thin and it kept stretching. So you kept having to make the shoe tight. I don't know what it was, but a lot of these things have like the origin of the theory or the origin of the way of doing it had no bearing on science or reality. It was just somebody just said, oh, I broke my shoelace. I'm going to have to figure out a way to make it tighter or something. And then the next thing you know, everybody's wearing really tight soccer cleats. But if you look at, there's a website that was called that has 25 pictures of the top 25 athletes in their sports and how horrible their feet look.
Have you seen Messi's feet? Messi's feet look, they look like his shoes. Like they look like a bullet, like really thin and then comes to a point.
No, the same thing with Usain Bolt. His feet are gnarly. LeBron James might have the ugliest feet of all. And again, they've been scrunched into this. And so you would go, okay, well, so wait a minute, Mark, what are you talking about? How are you arguing with Messi? He's the best in the world. Or LeBron, arguably one of the best ever. Well, I would say, you know, what if we fixed their feet? Maybe if they were even incrementally better. Yeah. You know, have you thought about that?
Yeah, I love that. What's the potential? What's the human potential?
Yeah.
Last question I have, as someone of Portuguese origin, I want to understand the name of your, I have a feeling I think I know.
You know it if you have Portuguese origin. Yes, what do you think? What do you think?
I think it's foot love.
Foot that's glove.
Love. Foot glove.
No, it's foot glove. Luva is glove.
Oh, okay.
Pé luva. Foot glove. Yeah.
I love that. Beautiful.
Yeah.
So, and where was the inspiration for it?
Well, so I, I've been the Primal guy for 30 years. So I've had 20 trademarks on things Primal, from Primal Fitness, Primal Urge Press, Primal Kitchen, Primal Blueprint, Primal Nutrition, Primal Fuel, Primal Health Coach Institute, so on and so forth. And I went to get Primal Footprint for footwear, and the name Primal was taken by somebody else, just the word Primal.
Oh.
Not even, and so that precluded any use of the word primal in there. So we had to come up with a new word. And we looked at a bunch of different language generators and, you know, what is foot, what is glove, comfort, all these different things.
Nice.
Anesi, A-N-E-S-I was one of the names in the running. Anesi was Greek for comfort. But we came up with Paluva, and we're 3 years into this company. We were 2 years of R&D, making sure we had wear testing everything and making sure everything was appropriate before we launched just as recently as this past March. So Paluva has been with us as a name for 3 years, and we internally love it. We've got a clothing line coming out that accompanies the shoes with the Paluva brand. And it's really exciting, because I feel like, you know, as much as I feel like I had an impact on the world of food manufacturing with Primal Kitchen, I think a lot of companies saw what we were doing and said, oh, we better get on that bandwagon and start making better for you mayonnaises and condiments and salad dressings. I feel the same way about footwear. I think we, the company that preceded us, the five-toed shoe that preceded us, had a massive opportunity, and I think they squandered it. And people should have been wearing this shoe for the last 20 years, this sort of five-toed, comfortable, foot-shaped shoe that improves performance, enhances health, and, you know, is generally just more comfortable than anything else you're wearing. So I felt compelled to enter the fray with this company.
Well, I'm so happy that you did. And I would also say, just as a woman, I'm training barefoot. I'm wearing these, let's say, 80% of the time. And then, you know, I'm still going to wear my heels. Like, I'm going to go.
And don't stop. Don't stop wearing those heels.
Okay. So that's like, you know, that's movement. Yes. You know, you talked about, you know, metabolic flexibility. We talked about cognitive flexibility. This is movement flexibility, right? Like, you do the right thing 80 to 85% of the time.
Yeah.
And then I get into these really high heels that are very uncomfortable. I definitely pronate. My feet are always sore, but I look good, and I do it for an evening, and it's here and there. It's not all the time. So,
like I say, don't stop doing that. That's not the point. The point is, you want, again, it's in the hours. I think you nailed it. That additional term, flexibility for the lifestyle thing part. Yeah. So we would have people spend most of their day barefoot if they could, or in Paluvas if they can't go barefoot, walking around doing their thing. And what we call it, passive training. You're passively training your feet all day long. And then when it's time to go do your thing, go run, put on your running shoes, go play soccer, put on your soccer cleats, basketball, go out to dinner, put on your heels, you know, but come up tomorrow, come back and get back into Paluvas and get enjoying the comfort of foot health.
And is it paluva.com? Is that where people can find the shoes?
That's it. Paluva.com. Yeah.
Awesome. And then just, if people already aren't following you, which they should be on Instagram, your Marxism Primal, anywhere else that people can find you, or the interact with you or the,
Paluva I mean, Primal. Mark's Daily Apple is the blog that I've had for 17 years now. And, so Mark's Daily Apple or, Marxism Primal on Instagram would be the two best, I think. Yeah.
Beautiful. Awesome. Well, let me just say, this has been just a delight talking to you. As I mentioned, I've been following you for many, many years. It's just been a highlight of my career to be able to have this conversation with you.
Oh, thank you so much.
And all the best to you for this company. I love it. As a chiropractor, the biomechanics works. And, you know, we didn't talk about I mentioned them briefly, but, you know, we were taught orthotics are the way for pronated feet. And, you know, when you think about, and I've changed my opinion on orthotics, I mean, there's always going to be some people who, you know, maybe as a temporary, same as, you know, the ketogenic diet, you need a there's a temporary intervention to help relieve the plantar fascia, but it's not something that should be there forever, right? We want to be retraining the foot to move properly.
Got to fix the root cause. Yep.
Exactly. Exactly. So,
and orthotics just mask the thing. They let you go out and do it again today without fixing the problem.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Cool. Okay. Awesome. Right. Well, we will have all these links in the show notes. Mark, thank you so much. We will share this with you when it's all produced. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And I must give you the obligatory legal and medical disclaimer here. This podcast, Better with Dr. Stephanie, is for general information only. And the advice, recommendations we discuss do not replace medicine, chiropractic, or any other primary healthcare provider's advice, treatment, or care. In the consumption of this podcast, there is no doctor-patient relationship that has been formed, and the use and implementation of the information discussed are at the sole discretion of the listener. The information and opinions shared on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for primary care, diagnosis, or treatment. In other words, guys, be smart about this. Take it with a grain of salt. Take this information to your primary healthcare provider and have a discussion with him or her to make the best choice that is for you. Remember, I am a doctor, but I am not your doctor. And these conversations are meant for educational purposes only.